Hello and welcome to Directions On Point, an interactive and live program with a top newsmaker in location technology. Hi, my name is Joe Francica. I'm the editor-in-chief of Directions Media, and today I'm in Huntsville, Alabama, and I'm joined by Adina Schutzberg, our executive editor. We will be your hosts for today's webcast featuring Mike Liebhold, a distinguished fellow for the Institute for the Future in Palo Alto, California. Mike, it's great to have you, and welcome to today's Directions On Point.
Hello, Joe. Adina, delighted to be here with you.
Thanks. We're going to get started very quickly. What I first wanted to do is get our audience informed about how to ask a question. We encourage you to ask questions, and in your control panel, there is a section called Questions. You can open that up and type in your question at any time during the webcast. And when we're ready to take your questions from the audience, I will be choosing a select few from those that we receive. So when you hear your name, I will take you off the mute button, and you can ask the questions directly to Mike. And in the event that there's a bit of a technical problem or you don't have your headset plugged in quite well, I will ask the question to Mike directly. Again, thanks for being here. We're going to start very shortly with some additional questions from Mike. I just wanted to remind everybody that there will be an on-demand recording made of today's webcast, and anybody who is a registered attendee will receive a copy of the link to that recorded version. Also wanted to thank Esri for sponsoring today's webcast with Mike Liebhold. And also, at the very end, you will receive an opportunity to take a survey. Tell us how we did, and we'd appreciate your feedback. Just a reminder that on an upcoming Directions On Point, we have on April 12th a conversation with Arnulf Kristal. He is the president of the Open Source Geospatial Foundation, OSGEO. And then April 19th, a conversation with Mark Reichert, the president of the Open Geospatial Consortium, that's OGC. So just a brief background or just a little information on what we're going to do here today. We're going to ask some questions of Mike, and we're going to give the audience a chance to respond after we've had our chance at Mike. We'll wrap up about 45 minutes past the hour, so we're going to get started. Mike, again, welcome. I just wanted to give a brief background. Mike is a distinguished fellow from the Institute of the Future. He was a past visiting researcher at Intel Labs and also spent some time at Netscape. He's had a lot of experience in the geospatial arena, and now that's kind of the focus of some of his basic research. So, Mike, again, welcome. I just really wanted to give you an opportunity to say hi to the audience and perhaps give a little background about what the Institute for the Future is, and just tell us what you're working on.
And hello, everyone. I'm delighted to be here with you today. I've been working at the Institute for the Future for the last 6 years. The Institute for the Future is a not-for-profit research laboratory that's been in business 42 years. IFTF.org was spun off of RAND Corporation in the 1960s by three eminent researchers who wanted to understand and help people understand the future. Paul Barron, one of our founders, is credited as one of the inventors of packet switch communications. Jacques Vallée was one of the early developers of a video on the ARPANET. And Olaf Helmer, one of our founders, was most famous for developing something called the Delphi method, a way of aggregating expert opinion about the future by circulating a white paper and aggregating everyone's comments together. And that is, in fact, what we do these days, although we don't circulate white papers. We use other methods. We aggregate expert opinions about the future. We don't predict the future, but we do help people use a variety of methodologies to get a clearer understanding or a systematic understanding of the future. My own work is in the technology area. I'm a digital technologist, and I work with most of our clients on elements that require something to do with computation or spatial information or wireless communications or artificial intelligence or digital media. Our clients at the Institute include very large corporations, companies like Intel, Procter & Gamble, Toyota, Disney, as well as government agencies, the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, Government of Singapore, Norwegian government, as well as public agencies like the Rockefeller Foundation. We help them all think systematically about the future. My own background in geospatial information goes back to the late 1970s, where I was inspired by work done by Professor Nicholas Negroponte at the MIT Architecture Machine Group, which was, in fact, the predecessor of the Media Lab, and Nicholas and his team working on something called SDMS, Spatial Data Management System, which was, in fact, a cinematic or video view of spatial information. And that's inspired my work since. And so I continued work on advanced spatial systems at Apple's Advanced Technology Labs for 10 years. I led a project called Terraform, which was something like what's become of Google Earth. And we did a lot of services, spatial prototypes using GPS and software tools like HyperCard, which was a very early web-like software tool. And so that's a little bit about my personal background and my institute work.
Mike, just prior to getting on live, you were telling us a little bit about what you're doing with augmented reality. Maybe you can just give us some insights of where you think that technology is headed.
Well, you know, I mean, since the kind of invention of cartography and mapping, and even through the entire era of digital GIS, humans have been interacting with spatial information on a flat plane. It's kind of a bird's eye view looking down at layers of geodata. But yet we move through the world, a physical world populated by digital data. So I personally believe that the natural way for humans to view and interact with spatial data in many cases is, in fact, not with from a bird's eye view, but actually in the first person or a cinematic perspective. So augmented reality is the capability of putting a digital overlay on the focal plane of view. Right now, augmented reality is kind of confined to clunky headsets or a view of graphical data in the viewfinder of your phone. So the viewfinder is beginning to become like a web browser. So we're in the very, very earliest stages of augmented reality, where companies are just beginning to display spatial information in the viewfinders of phones. It's kind of a temporary capability that will evolve over the next decade or so, so that people will have a much more intimate first-person view of the spatial data that we're all immersed in.
But you know, one of the problems I have with AR is that, you know, we're stuck in this mode of, oh, it's great for tourism and it's kind of neat to see historical, you know, pieces of information. But there's got to be more value to it than just the tourism apps. I know there are some apps in asset management and things that, you know, would allow crowdsource information to get back to a city government official to fix potholes. So there's neat things coming on, but there's really got to be some more. So any ideas of where this really would be headed for a more useful user experience?
Sure. You know, first off, let's talk a little bit about the mechanical limitations of interacting with augmented reality. Right now, yeah, you've got to hold up the viewfinder of a device, of your phone or your tablet, to see the information about the world. It's really awkward. But there are, in fact, contact lenses in development in laboratories right now with wireless communications. Probably in about 7 or 8 years, we'll see the first versions of these contact lenses coming out of the laboratory, so people will be able to put on a pair of contact lenses and walk around the world and see digital information on the world. And then probably another 5 to 8 years after that, they should be consumer priced. And so anyone can walk around and interact with spatial information. In the next 5 years, we'll see the first generations. So there's the timeline, the adoption timeline. We don't necessarily need to be convinced of the use cases now. We have about 10 or 15 years to really kind of work this out. But this is something I do think about deeply, and I can talk to you a little bit about some of the usage. First off, it's important to realize that that spatial data was originally, much of it was created to be pressed together into 2D maps. But there is an enormous amount of data coming online. For the last 5 to 8 years, we've seen through the works of the Open Geospatial Consortium and companies like ESRI, we're seeing, and public agencies all over the world, we're seeing vast amounts of geodata available on web servers. We're seeing vast amounts of web-based information, social web information, geocoded tweets, check-in information from social networks beginning to be available on servers online. And then we're seeing the beginnings of very rich sensor networks coming online with spatial information that could be viewed. But the applications really kind of depend on sort of shifting our understanding. I think if we think 10 to 15 years out and imagine that we can see the digital information in the world, it means that the world is going to become self-explanatory for whatever reasons humans need the world to explain themselves. For example, if you're an engineer, you'll be able to look at a wall and see the framing of the wall behind the plaster. If you're a road engineer, you can look out at the street and you can see all the engineering specifications of everything in the roadway. If you are a marketing person, you'll be able to walk down the street and see demographic and psychographic and social information and cultural information about the consumer base in the physical world in a commercial environment. If you're a consumer who wants to play games, then the physical space will be rich with fully three-dimensional photorealistic graphical objects in the real world. So game and game type of entertainment is going to escape from the console and populate the physical world around us. Every object, every machine will be self-documented. So you'll be able to glance at a machine and see an instruction manual. You might even see a media piece that coaches you how to use the machine. Or if you're a technician, you can see the schematics of the machine, a three-dimensional exploded view, and the maintenance procedure. So the applications for persistent immersive spatial information are going to depend on humans gradually shifting understanding of the real world is not just a physical world, but the real world is dense with spatial information. So there are going to be many, many new applications for trivially and formally using spatial information for almost any kind of task we can think of.
Right.
So the real world is really becoming the user interface to all of this data in some sense.
Well, I mean, it's not the world becoming the user interface. It is that, but it's more than that. It's that the world is a computational platform for information.
Okay, help me understand that, because that's a big leap beyond just seeing the data where I need it.
Right. It's visualization is only the first step for application of geodata. We'll begin to compute on geodata. So you might be mine geodata. You might do pattern recognition on geodata. You know, for Google Goggles is a visual search. That's taking photographic information is all geodata, by the way. It's taking that photographic information and doing a massive pattern search and coming back with information about the visual object. So we're actually computing on the photons, which are information about the physical world. We can imagine that our computer systems, our handhelds, or our cloud services will know enough about us, our agenda, our itinerary, our intentions, maybe our biases and preferences, our social networks, so that our computer services will begin to proactively compute on our behalf and then arrange the spatial experience proactively before we even get to a destination. So the system is going to be aware of the physical space you're in and the physical space that you're traveling towards, and be able to cue things up for you that are optimally filtered for your task or profile or preferences.
And so that is basically strictly on what you just said, so that somewhere there's going to be some accumulated knowledge, maybe some information about you that would say, I'm going along this route. I may be interested in, I don't know, that store, that restaurant, that item over there, that is going to queue up information for me without my interaction. Is that what you're suggesting?
Yeah, it's what Eric Schmidt, the CEO of Google, has been talking about, is autonomous search. And Google is, in fact, building, you know, their entire service architecture to be able to perform services like that. I mean, they're already making billions, if not trillions, on contextual advertising. So the more that the entire Google service of family knows about you, the more that it can actually compute on all of the information that you touch, including spatial information. It's funny, the term autonomous search is a Microsoft term, and a couple of Microsoft engineers actually did the first research on it, but now no doubt Google's probably got dozens of people, if not more, working on the idea of autonomous search, or what a lot of people call context-aware computing. Mm-hmm. So if the computer service knows your context, it can compute on that and do things on your behalf.
Hey, can we switch gears for a second?
Yeah, go ahead, Adina. Yeah.
I think we're heading in this direction anyway. So let's talk about the cloud a little bit. And I think my definition of the cloud right now for geospatial, and maybe more broadly, is basically a place to put your stuff. Whether you've got data stuff or you've got application stuff, you can do it in this place that is not local. But clearly that's just the beginning. We've just got the toe in the water, very much like with augmented reality. So where are you thinking about cloud computing in the next 5 years for geospatial?
Well, yeah, as you mentioned, the conventional wisdom about cloud computing is that it's computing as a service, or applications as a service, or software as a service. And, you know, the most thinking in industry is that, well, okay, I just contract for some computing capability, and I don't need to spend a lot of money for capital equipment. You know, that's the conventional wisdom what the cloud's about. But the truth is that there's a much more fundamental disruption at work here. The people are beginning to realize that the cloud is an almost infinitely, not infinite, but a vastly scalable supercomputer, so that we can begin to think of computing applications of having almost unlimited computation. We're not limited by the processors on our mobile devices anymore, is that we can actually harness vast amounts of parallel processes to do a whole spectrum of new kinds of tasks for us. So we can begin to trivially employ tasks for pattern matching, data mining, high-resolution rendering, complex large-scale models. All of those are enabled by supercomputing on demand. And so people at Google realize this. Eric Schmidt talks about your mobile device is your supercomputer in your pocket. And he's not talking about the multi-core CPU or GPU on your device. He's talking about Google's cloud service. Amazon's Elastic Cloud is offering their first supercomputing services, and I have no doubt that that others at Microsoft and elsewhere are beginning to get it, that it's all about supercomputing. So we can think of the supercomputing as sort of transforming our interaction with each other and with information. I've been thinking about a notion I call supercharged interaction, so that we can do things like I mentioned, Google goggles. The idea of visual search is that anything that a sensor can see can be harvested. The way Google goggles works is that it takes a snapshot from your phone and it compares it against millions of samples in the Google index, and it finds a match, And then from that, that's a search template, and it can search and bring you up a whole dossier of information about whatever it is was in your viewfinder. That kind of capability, a visual search of spatial information, of photographs, takes vast parallel computing power. The same technique can enable us to translate languages in real time, so that we can have a real time dialogue. I mean, you could be speaking Persian and Thai with me, and I could speak English, and we could all converse with each other sometime in the future. Language translation will be done trivially. It's going to transform the way we render information. Right now, we've been limited in the ability to map vectors or do just some simple two-dimensional graphing. And now we're seeing the first generation of fairly flat three-dimensional graphics, but the cloud computer is going to enable us to render anything, including spatial data, in very high-resolution three-dimensional shapes. In fact, photorealistic shapes. You'll be able to see actual graphical objects or graphical data in high format in the real world. So that kind of supercomputing is going to transform the way we work with spatial data.
I got a question. I want to take you to something fairly mundane in the geospatial realm and see if this is kind of along the concepts of contextual computing. If I'm a forester, for example, and I walk into a forest and my job is to not only count trees but identify forest types, forest cover. Are you suggesting if I walk into a forest and I have, my newest pair of contact lenses or any sort of a headset, will I be able to actually render an interpretation of the forest in front of me? In other words, I look at a tree, I know that's a Doug fir tree. I look at another tree, and that's a eastern maple tree. And all of a sudden, by looking at the vast surroundings, I'm able to compute forest canopy, forest volume of trees. Is that the kind of contextual computing and image interpretation, immersive media that I may be able to get in the future?
Yeah, but I mean, it's going to be totally dependent on the availability of data and an availability of a network connection. So, for example, in the case of a forest, you would assume that someone had done aerial surveys or satellite surveys and have a variety of sensor information. So that will become the base level of data that you can view. And then the recognition of a fir tree as opposed to a maple tree would require, in fact, cloud computing. So the constraint there is, gosh, do you have a broadband connection to the network out there in the forest? Well, maybe you won't. I mean, this is one of the gating factors. Despite all the big news about 4G and LTE and WiMAX and a variety of other broadband capabilities, the reach of broadband communications to the kind of wilderness fringes is still a long, long ways off. And so your augmented reality in that forest is going to be constrained not just by the availability of useful data, but the availability of a broadband connection. But if we kind of imagine that somehow somebody has built, dragged a high bandwidth access point out there in the woods with you, and you've got broadband connection, then yeah, you might be able to actually not only recognize the tree, but have the computing system calculate the health of the tree. It might give you a view of the ecological dynamics of the forest around you, including soils information, microclimate information, information about the wildlife in the forest, atmospheric information, meteorological information. All of that information would be available, of course, dependent on the broadband connectivity.
Right, right. I guess I was hoping we had solved that problem. If I had solved the problem of real-time image processing, I was hoping we would have solved broadband by that time as well.
No,
bring up another problem that we haven't solved in that little scenario.
Yeah.
And that's access to data. I mean, let's face it, we're still living in a whole series of different little walled gardens, and who's to say that the data that you need is going to be not just available, but accessible in an interoperable fashion to be plugged into this system that we just talked about.
Yeah, you're right, Anita. That's, you know, that's so true. Is there, there's vast amounts of geodata out on the network, but it's just not indexed very well. There's no useful metadata. And you know, we're not even sure. You know, there are collections of data where the layers are not labeled. There's repositories where the collections are not well indexed. And even the academic communities, the scientific communities, the foresters, the biologists, the botanists, the microclimate experts are all using slightly different metadata or semantics to describe the geodata in their fields. But we are seeing groups like the National Science Foundation funding projects so the different scientific disciplines begin to create some kind of common ontologies for spatial data. And we're seeing, you know, fairly significant trend towards putting web data up in a RESTful format. That is where every data object has its own URI or a URL, URI, Universal Resource Indicator, on the web. And we're seeing, in many cases, people are labeling the data with common semantics. You know, the Ordnance Survey in the UK, for example, is using the semantic web to index some of their data based on work that Sir Tim Berners-Lee from the World Wide Web Consortium has developed. There's actually a growing body of spatial information that will be available indexed in semantic web formats in a common grammar called RDF, Resource Description Framework, so that we'll begin to do machine inference about geodata across repositories. But you're right, we're a long ways away, and there's lots and lots of human work involved in creating a common metadata about our geodata and other kinds of data, sensor data, and all of the other data about our lives is still in very primitive formats.
And yet I have to say what you just described is probably one of the more positive visions of geodata for the future that I've heard, because I've been very pessimistic and frustrated of late. This gives me hope.
Well, you know, I mean, just think about brute force computing. If nothing else, we could take files, and if we have unlimited computing, we can actually post-index files that were created for other purposes. And so, you know, people can begin to think about brute force approaches towards classifying and categorizing geodata.
Well, Adina, if you have any other questions, I'm going to take a question here from the audience, unless you've got another one.
No, let the audience ask.
Yeah, I know a few people came on board to ask, you know, what your thoughts were on future uses of GPS. I mean, we've had a long history of GPS, and we've embedded it in so many things. It seems to be commonplace now. So that was one of the questions that came in. I think I had sent you as a kind of give you a heads up on that. So maybe just your thoughts on that.
Well, gosh, you know, GPS is incredibly helpful because it's enabling all of us to both use and create coarse-grained spatial information with our mobile devices. But the real revolution in spatial information is going to come from precision positioning. So we're going to have to get a lot better spatial resolution than we're getting out of our satellites.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and gosh, at best, without differential GPS augmentation of the signal, you get about 10 to 20 meters accuracy. So in some of the labs, people are now, and services like Skyhook and so forth are doing sensor fusion where they augment the GPS signal with the known locations of Wi-Fi base stations. And, you know, there are other scenarios of doing it electronically. One of the most promising directions for the future of precise positioning is, in fact, photo positioning. If you have a reference database, a visual database where every pixel in the image is a known location, you can then use the cloud supercomputer to compare what's in your focal plane with the reference data to calculate a very precise position. So companies like EarthMine in Berkeley, who actually are driving cities all over the world and creating these maps where every pixel in the database is accurate within millimeters, they're creating an ideal reference platform for sort of this visual reckoning of your precise position. And so similar techniques using both photo recognition and sensor fusion are going to allow us to map indoor spaces, finally, in some detail. So I think over the next 10 or 15 years, we're going to find a variety of ways using, you know, new kinds of differential GPS techniques, sensor fusion, and visual reckoning to create a whole new generation of precise spatial information.
One of the things you mentioned to us relates to one of the questions that the audience brought in, which was how will mobile communications affect economic growth in emerging economies? I think you had said you've been working with some of the emerging markets.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's very exciting. We can forecast that probably by 2020, every human on the planet will be able to afford a device of iPhone or Android phone capabilities, a credit card-sized device that has computing power, has high-performance rendering capabilities of graphics, video, and audio. It's got position sensing, and it's got a local store for personal information, and it has multiple modes of wireless communications. The paradox or the dilemma is that although people will be able to afford these devices, it's not clear that disadvantaged or excluded populations will be able to afford the Kinect minutes at all. That people are beginning now to scrounge for prepaid minutes, but the economics of telecommunications are daunting. And in a lot of the places in the world where you think it would be to the benefit of the population at large to offer free broadband wireless to everyone, it turns out that in those countries, one of the few profit-making arms of the government is, in fact, the public telephone company, which is owned by the government, that makes revenue for the government. And a lot of these guys are just not willing to cannibalize their own business case to offer free broadband to poor people. So we're going to see things like what are called DTN networks, delay-tolerant networks, where your interaction with Internet protocols is episodic. So if you're in a public Wi-Fi zone, you'll have access, broadband access. If you're not, you'll still be able to do some computing. But, you know, we're seeing, for example, right here in Palo Alto, California, where I live, there's a high density, as you might imagine, of people carrying around smartphones. Now, if everybody's walking around this neighborhood and thinks that they're going to get 3 megabits or 7 megabits connection with the local cell tower, they've got to understand that that cell tower may only have a T1 connection to the cloud. So the phone companies are playing this kind of multiplex game where they figure out a ratio of how many users want to use the access connection, and they've got a ratio, and they're under-provisioned. And what we've learned from iPhone particularly is that all of the models for the provision of wireless networks were based on a very old assumption of narrow bandwidth voice and maybe, you know, simple message system, SMS, text communications. But people are now communicating with the broadband World Wide Web and broadband video, and they're just blowing the access capabilities of these wireless networks. Once the data is in the cloud, it moves pretty quickly. But it turns out that all of these wireless access points, 3G, 4G, all of them have very, very constrained network connections to the cloud. So, you know, right here, so if I pull out my phone right here in downtown Palo Alto, it's chancy whether or not I'm going to get a good data connection. And, you know, so that as a result, AT&T has said, well, we have to invest tens of billions of dollars upgrading our networks. It's the same worldwide. There's a huge burden on the telecommunications companies to spend billions and billions of dollars to build out the networks to take advantage of the power of these new multimedia devices that we're all carrying. So it's going to be a few years before most disadvantaged populations are going to have access to all of the benefits of wireless broadband communications.
Right. I've got a question here with from Lucas Vandercroft. Lucas, if your headset is enabled, I'll ask you to ask your question directly to Mike.
Yes, thank you, Joe. I was just wondering if you can say anything about how these advances will affect, you know, the systems as you know it, as it relates to the economics of networks and economics for our society. You know, it even goes into governmental structures. You know, we see huge uprisings now in certain parts of the world, and it seems like, you know, our public infrastructure to make decisions and set policies are quite, you know, old. And it seems like, you know, with sensor networks, we could get our hands on much more accurate, up-to-date information to enable much better policymaking and governance of our societies.
Well, you're right. You're right. I mean, vast amounts of data are transforming our governments. And I have to say that the people leading our planet are still not among the digital natives. They're not really literate in the computing and telecommunications capabilities. So we might have to wait a few decades. I mean, the children now, I mean, I was looking at my grandchildren this morning, and they've got iPod touches. And, you know, they're sitting in front of a 1080 progressive scan HDTV sets in their households. And they will never know a time when wireless communications, the World Wide Web, and high-definition imagery didn't exist. So by the time these generations of people are in the leadership, 10, 15, 20 years, we'll have populations of leaders that I think are more equipped to utilize the power of telecommunications, data processing, spatial information, advanced media. So until then, we're just going to have to muddle through and help our leaders learn to use the kind of vast capability and make their decisions in a kind of a forward-looking perspective, based on the disruptions that we see are inevitable.
We got another question here. Selva Ganagaval, if you're there, you can ask your question directly of Mike.
Mr. Mike, actually, for a spatial enabling process is very well established in GIS framework. About dynamics, especially fluids or stress transfer or state transfer, isn't real-time possible or available in GIS?
You know, I'm having a very difficult time with your connection. I wondered if I may ask if you could type a quick summary in the window so I could respond. I think we don't have a very, very good connection. Might be my connection on this end.
I'm going to put it in the chat window, Mike, and let you read the question directly. Essentially what it said is spatially enabling processes is very well established in a GIS framework. What about dynamics, especially fluids, stress transfer, state transfer, and is it possible in real time or available in GIS?
Yeah, I would say inevitably, as supercomputing comes online as just a general utility resource, we can do all kinds of things. We can see fluid trends in a first-person view, in a cinematic or AR view. We'll be able to calculate probabilities. I mean, the world around us is potent in probabilities. We'll be able to actually visualize and compute on the probabilities in the spaces around us. So we're only in the beginnings of understanding what it means. But yes, the kinds of fluid state and dynamic situations requiring complex modeling will all be possible over the next 5, 10, 15 years using cloud supercomputing and cloud-based rendering to see very, very high-resolution presentations that could include, in fact, annotated physics of all things. You know, imagine a supercomputer visualization of ordinary things in the world. That will all be possible, and it's all spatial.
I'll ask a question here that we got in from one of our people who had registered. What's the most important lesson that an enterprise can learn from GIS on the web? And we had talked a little bit about this. We seemed also to be at the very early stages of cloud computing, GIS, you know, satellite image processing on the web or in the cloud. We're at that early stages. So maybe from this perspective in this day and time, what's the most important lesson an enterprise can learn for integrating geospatial technology in their enterprise?
Well, you know, I have to pass a bouquet to you, Joe. I think you invented the term location intelligence, and that is exactly the right framework, the right lens to think about your future, is to walk around the world and imagine the decisions you could make if you had computational access to the information in your spaces. So imagine being able to process your logistics, to be able to process your supply chains, to be able to process information about your real-time market dynamics among your customers, to be able to process your design, to be able to compute your design processes and your daily activities. And so location intelligence is exactly the right way to think about it, and then sort of design sort of the computational processes. And the good news is, one of the cool things about the cloud is, you know, computing is pretty cheap. Around here in the Silicon Valley, you know, as recently as 10 years ago, if somebody wanted to do a startup, they had to, you know, write a really formalized business plan and then go beg some venture capitalists for $10 or $20 million to build a private data center. These days, the kids here on University Avenue in Palo Alto, they'll sit in the coffee shop, they'll write a Ruby on Rails script, and then they'll go and book some on-demand time on the Amazon Elastic Cloud, and they'll be online with a service in 10 days. So organizations have got to become that agile as the startup kids are around here. And so that means using the cloud to compute with your spatial data and all of your other enterprise data dynamically and quickly, and not being hung up in the previously high requirements for capital expenses. The capital right. expenses are going away.
Right, yeah, that's a good point. Idina, any last thoughts?
I'd like to ask one more question if I can.
Yeah, go right ahead.
I'm wondering, Mike, in your 6 years at the Institute for the Future, and while I know that you don't predict the future, but you help others take advantage of it, what kind of insights could you share with us, sort of regular geospatial people who are trying to prepare ourselves for the future and get ready for it?
Yeah, I think the most important thing for spatial professionals is kind of get your mind up and out of the Cartesian plane and just start performing kind of the thought exercise to think deeply about the spatial information in your field of view, to think about, not necessarily augmented reality, but to think about sort of the density of spatial information in a world where everything, the digital world is as visible as the physical world, and that the digital world is not only visible, but it can be computed. And so on the Cartesian display, the two-dimensional display of geodata, and think of geodata as a computational element, and to think of geodata as persistent and dense in the physical world.
That's quite a lot to ask, but I think it starts with sort of getting yourself out of thinking about the day-to-day GIS that you do and really sort of free your mind to these new ways of thinking.
Well, I just do it when I walk around the real world. I just imagine I can see the geodata. I imagine that the world is self-revealing. I can look at that coffee cup and say, oh, that was made in Waukegan, Illinois in 1996. This table is composite material, and oh, I can see the schematic on this speakerphone here. You know, I mean, it's a thought exercise that can prepare you. Look at the wall and imagine you can see the conduit behind the plaster. Look at the street and imagine you can see the fiber optics under the street. Look at the tree and imagine you can see a schematic of the biological structures in a tree. All of that information will become visible in our lifetime. And
I think that's a wonderful piece of homework to leave our listeners with.
Yeah, I would absolutely agree.
That.
Yeah, go think about the world around you and all of the spatial attributes that can be attached to the elements in the physical space. Well, Mike, I want to thank you. Yeah, go ahead.
I was just going to say it's sort of inevitable. It's inexorable. So the more we think about it now, the better prepared we are to deal with it when it arrives.
Well, that's great. Well, Mike, we really want to thank you for your time today. It's been a great discussion, and I do want to leave it there because it's certainly a lot of food for thought. So we really appreciate your time.
Oh, my pleasure, Joe and Idina. Thank you so much for inviting me to participate, and I look forward to continuing reading all the great work from Directions Media.
Well, good. Thanks, Mike. And thanks to all of you who are viewers. We'll hope to see you on another Directions On Point or a Directions Media webinar. We hope that you'll subscribe to our daily publications on Directions Magazine and certainly our weekly Directions on the News podcast that are syndicated on iTunes. And this particular webcast will also be syndicated on iTunes as a podcast. So look for that when you subscribe to our podcast. Thanks again to all of you again for joining us today on Directions On Point with Mike Leopold. We appreciate you being here. Thanks, and be sure to tell a friend about directions. Bye-bye for now. Take care.